Hey everybody, welcome back to the Voices in Japan podcast. My name is Burke and I am co-hosting this podcast with Ben. Today we're going to talk about studying Japanese and cover our own experiences and what we struggled with over the years. We're also going to touch on a lot of the techniques and methods that we've used to improve our Japanese. And there are many hints about how you can also improve your Japanese throughout the podcast. We also talk about the Japanese proficiency test, which is administered twice a year. We think this is a topic that a lot of people certainly have interest in, so please sit back and enjoy the episode.
1, 2, 3. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode with Burke and I. And today we're going to talk about, studying Japanese. Is it really hard to study Japanese? So let's get to it. What do you think, Burke? Is it hard to study Japanese?
Well, I think anybody who's trying to start studying a new language, there's a lot of different approaches that you can take. And obviously, the most effective approach has always been immersion. So getting in that place, that country that speaks the language is, of course, one of the best ways to do it.
And we have it because we're like fully immersed. I don't know. Yeah, we are fully immersed, I guess, because we live in Japan. When did you start studying Japanese?
Well, of course, I'm half Japanese. So I heard it when I was growing up, especially when my mom was angry. I especially heard at that time, but it's funny because my older brother and my older sister, like, we lived here actually when I was a baby, and my brother and my sister, I was just a baby, like 2 years old, so I was barely even speaking anything. But my older brother and sister were speaking Japanese at that time, and then we went back to the U.S. My mom was speaking with them for like a couple of years, and then apparently they stopped speaking Japanese very suddenly, and so when I became of the age where I was kind of talking a lot, she had already given up basically teaching her children how to speak Japanese. So myself and my two younger sisters did not grow up speaking Japanese at home, except for we knew a few words. So I think that's probably when my studying experience started, was way back when I was a kid and growing up, I heard it. So there was a lot of input going on, I think. But
Your Japanese is good now because, I mean, how long have you been studying and for how long you've been living in Japan, you know, you have pretty much almost the highest level of Japanese, right?
Yeah.
You use it every day.
When I was in university, I had a lot of Asian friends who were all bilingual with their mother tongue or their parents' mother tongue. So that always motivated me. And then when I came over here, the plan was just to come over here for a year because the American economy was bad. And I was just going to come here and study, I thought, Japanese for like a year or two while I taught English and become like completely fluent. But obviously it's a lot more difficult than that. But when I came over here and I started in that English teaching bubble. But like I was on a mission, man. Like every day I would go home after work and just study. I knew like as soon as I got here, the first thing I was going to do was like find a Japanese teacher. Like I had a lot of this planned out even before I came over because my goal was just to become fluent as quickly as possible. It took a lot longer, but I had that mission right away.
So you would say you are fluent now?
I'm definitely fluent. I mean, do business in Japanese now. Because, there's the test, the proficiency test.
Yeah, the JLPT, Japanese Language Proficiency Test.
Yeah, and they hold those twice a year. It might be more now, but when I first came, it was like in the summer and at the end of December.
Yeah, it's still the same now. Okay. I took one recently in the last summer, JLPT N3. So I passed N3, which
Congratulations.
It's pretty, considering how long I've been here, N3 is disappointing for me. I mean, N3 is, how would you describe it in terms of fluency level? Like one is fluent, would you say?
Yeah, well, they say, all right, I guess now there's like five levels.
Yeah,
well,
N5.
Yeah,
right.
So I think it's basically N2. Is like most companies that are hiring and they want somebody who has a Japanese fluency level, they're usually looking for N2.
N2 minimum.
Yeah, N1 is like you can read newspapers. You're not I mean, they call it native level, but there's a difference between native level, a person who's grown up here.
People always want to know, is it hard to learn Japanese? But you can't, you got to kind of class Japanese separately, right? Because they have, there's the speaking, but then there's the whole writing system, kanji. That's like another language in itself.
Yeah.
I found, because I mean, when I came, I decided not to study kanji or writing or reading, which was a stupid reason. I don't know why I decided that. I think when I came here, I was like, I want to learn Japanese, but I just want to be able to speak it fluently or speak it really well. That was the goal. I was like, I'm not going to learn how to read or write. And it wasn't until after living here for 8 years that I actually started to study the writing and the reading, the kanji right. now,
yeah.
which is why I'm only N3. But in terms of conversational wise, I think I'm high. I don't know how you can really measure. There's no really measure of a conversation level, especially for the JLPT, right?
Because no.
it just measures reading and writing. Well, not even writing, reading and listening.
And listening. Everyone kind of studies up to what's necessary for going up, what's going on in their lives. So, for example, my Japanese jumped completely, obviously, when I started working in a company that was mostly speaking Japanese every day. I mean, again, I started studying in like October when I got here. I didn't take the test that December, but I took the test the next December, and I took N2, and I passed it. And, you know, that was after like 1 year of studying. But
that was 1 year of like intense studying when you first arrived.
Yeah, like studying like 2 hours every day after like teaching until like 12 to 9 p.m. And then I would like go to these classes, Japanese. I went to, like, as soon as I got here, I started looking for a Japanese school, which is something you got to do. But I got lucky because I met one of these teachers at this school. She was a part-time teacher, and she decided to actually quit that school. It made more sense for her to be teaching at her place. But so I would take these classes with her like 3 times a week in the morning before work, and then I would go work, and then afterward I would study for like 2 hours. And anybody who I met who had like passed like N1, back then they just called it like Ikkyu, Nikkyu. There was only 4 levels, so it was a little bit different. But they were like,
it was a bit easier then, wasn't it? Like, they made it harder, basically, now.
No, actually.
The end levels.
Oh, yeah. Well, the top level is a little bit harder, or it is harder, yeah, than it used to be. But EQ back then was still, like, untouchable for a lot of people, you know?
Well, I mean, like, a big issue was because there wasn't any speaking and kanji, which most people know is derived from Chinese characters. So Chinese people would come over to Japan. They don't know any Japanese, and they could pretty much ace the test and get level 1 because they know all the readings.
Even though their speaking isn't.
Yeah, speaking isn't. Their listening might be passable. You can guess anyway. But when they took the test, they were getting level 1s, but they weren't. You know, level 1 is supposed to mean you're a very high level Japanese communicator or speaker, but they couldn't speak.
Right.
So then they changed the test to this new N level, and I think they made it harder, but it's still a lot of Chinese can come over, not study very hard, and they could pass the test quite easily.
Yeah, man. You know, I've taken the so I passed that N2 like after that first year, and then after that it was like going for N1, and there were several years where I failed it, and I finally passed it. But sitting in that class in the test room for the N1 with a lot of Chinese people, and unfortunately there's this like stereotype that a lot of them cheat, but I've seen people cheating on every single time.
How can they cheat? You mean like just like look at other people's papers?
Yeah, because they're in the room with somebody they know, and there was a girl sitting in front of me, and the whole test she would just like whisper really quietly to the other guy. And then he would like move his hand, and she was just like looking over at his sheet.
Oh my god! Seriously,
and
blatantly cheating.
Yeah, and
I guess that there's not like I've done the test, and there's not many kind of people walking around, and you're quite close to the people around you.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people taking it. Yeah, I mean, and they do walk around, but they're not. I mean, I've never heard of anybody getting in trouble for anything on those tests before, even though it is a really like strict kind of setting. The proctors are all wearing suits and everything, but a lot of people that come over here, you know, teaching English. And one of the difficult things about studying Japanese when you're teaching English is because you're kind of expected to, I mean, you are in this English bubble at work, and you are kind of expected not to speak Japanese with these students. I don't know if you did or not.
No, I'm exactly the same. I completely agree that when you're an English teacher, it's definitely a lot harder to study English because, oh, sorry, study Japanese, because you're expected to speak English to your students all the time. Most of your coworkers are English teachers as well.
Right.
So you're probably speaking English with them. Even the Japanese ones, they usually have good enough English.
Yeah, and they want to keep their English level up. So they kind of hope that you, I mean, I think they expect you also to speak in English to them, Japanese teachers.
Yeah, so probably the best way to actually speak Japanese is not be an English teacher for one.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, because, you know, you could obviously go outside and go meet some Japanese people. But when you're surrounded by English most of the day, it's not really an immersion situation.
Well, and then after work, you're like too tired to study, or you don't have time. I mean, you're going out with people, but unless it was like you, if you don't meet somebody, you know, at the bar, so make some friends, then... And even when you do, a lot of them are speaking English anyways.
Especially at the beginning when you first arrive in Japan, right? It's not until later on when you can kind of have a conversation and then you can start actually meeting Japanese people that don't speak English.
Yeah.
And that's when you really kind of learn the language, you know,
yeah.
Like how normal people speak.
Right. Well, I mean, they say like one of the best things that you can do is, you know, pick up a girlfriend if you're a guy, or, you know, pick up a boyfriend if you're a girl.
I agree with that. I mean, I remember when I was dating a Japanese girl, my Japanese level just went through the roof, when the ones that couldn't speak English, because I would have to speak Japanese. And then, you know, you have arguments and you use it. The normal everyday Japanese that you have to use to have a successful relationship, and you learn fast that way.
Yeah.
But so yeah, I highly recommend getting a Japanese partner if you really want a Japanese that doesn't speak English, because if their English is better than their Japanese, or is better than your Japanese, you're going to be probably speaking English most of the time.
Yeah, I would say like that is probably the most important. I mean, there's a kind of a joke they say, like, what's the best way to learn Japanese? Have you heard this before?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I say horizontally.
Yeah, yeah.
I've gone to a lot of these intensive courses in Sapporo, actually, over the years. And I've actually gone to a couple of schools here as well. Those always help, too, but they're, you know, you got to pay for them. They're a little bit expensive. Another thing that I would say, obviously, if you work... that's going to put your Japanese in another level. But those tests too, the proficiency tests, because those kind of put pressure on you. And whenever I've studied for one of those tests and the build up to it, it's just like any other test. Like you just overload you. I mean, you're just like
you grind it out.
Yeah,
grind it out. And there's a lot to say for grinding things out, because you might be like taking a lot of information and probably not remembering most of it. But just grinding it and learning new stuff, pushing yourself. Some of it, a lot of it goes in. Maybe not all of it, but a lot of it does go in. And then later on, maybe you don't pass the test or something, but it's good to cram. Like, I mean, with anything, really. If you cram a lot, you're going to learn a lot anyway.
Yeah.
So how many years, when you came into Japan, did you pass level one?
Well, actually, after coming to Japan, it was probably like 7 years, six years or 7 years. But I would actually say that my true Japanese studying didn't start until after I stopped teaching English. Because when I stopped teaching English, I was like, I made a decision that I was kind of like, I got to get my Japanese to like the level where I can work in a company. And so I went to like this half a year college program where I was a research student, and it was like, intensive. Obviously, I mean, you were attending college courses or university courses in Japanese, writing papers, in Japanese too, and everything. So that was where, like, I made another big jump. And at that point, I thought, you know, here I thought I was fluent. But then when I joined this company, and then there was another foreign guy in there, and he was like, you know, doing his everyday things at the company in Japanese and everything. And then I realized that's a truly different level.
So do you think like the highest kind of level is when you can work in a proper Japanese company, like in a relatively good, important position?
I think it like never ends. You go to something like a like funeral, you know, in Japanese, and all of a sudden you realize you don't, or like you hear like the Buddhist monk or something talking or doing those prayers. You know, it's just all these other specialized things that you don't learn about if you don't know
just so the it's background. What, just vocabulary, would you say?
Or yeah, it, well, mostly like vocabulary.
Can you tell jokes in Japanese?
Can I tell jokes in Japanese? Like a Japanese joke?
No, just like, you know, tell jokes constantly in Japanese. Like if you were, you know, maybe like tell a funny story or something like that. Because, you know, a lot of people measure fluency on if you can understand the humor and tell jokes, make jokes, make people laugh.
Yeah, in see, exactly.
Same language.
Yeah,
and no, that is I a can't. Different level of fluency.
Exactly. Yeah, and I can't do that. But I know a guy in Tokyo who actually performs on stage.
Well, like stand up.
Yeah, I mean it's not stand up, but it's Japanese. What is it called? Manzai or something?
Oh yeah, yeah, when it's like pair.
Yeah, pair
comedy.
Yeah, and like if I'm out drinking with people at the company, or even when we're talking around work, like I can say something that's funny and people laugh at it. But I think what you're talking about, you know, like doing something like that. I mean, yeah, I can make people laugh, but this guy that I know that, you know, performs and stuff, his, obviously that's a different level too, you know.
So what would you say are the best ways to learn Japanese?
I would say, again,
let's say top three best ways
For somebody who is already in Japan, because that's the first step. You gotta make it here. But after you get here, I would say number one is get a tutor.
So you think like a private tutor is better than like a group lesson or something?
I think, I mean, some people say like group lessons are better because you can kind of hear, pick up what where other people are at, or pick things up from them as well, you know. But so I think there's probably advantages to both. Yeah.
Okay, so get a tutor, right?
Yeah, get a job, like a non-English teaching job, even if it's like working at izakaya or something. It's like a bartender.
So that one would be something you couldn't do straight away, right? Like when you arrive in Japan, like the first one you could find a tutor. You can find like a beginner level teacher, but to work in a Japanese company, that's
Impossible. Yeah, but it doesn't need to be a company. Like a friend of ours, he worked at a yakitori place.
Oh, like a grilled chicken meat restaurant.
Exactly.
For the viewers that don't know, or the listeners that don't know what yakitori is. Yeah. Meat on sticks.
Meat on sticks, yeah. Or like any kind of restaurant like that, because a lot of them will take foreigners. I mean, they just need help, you know.
Right, and they don't really need to speak to customers, just, you know, learn some keywords, right?
Yeah, you got to be able to make the food. But, yeah, if you're talking to the customers, it can be in English. I mean, they might just enjoy chatting with you in English anyways. But, I mean, with the staff or with the regular customers, eventually you're going to start picking up and speaking Japanese with them. Plus, if you're studying on the side, ideally is like, yeah, you get your Japanese to a level where you can work in a company. But any kind of job, yeah.
All right, so we got to get a tutor and work for a Japanese company.
Yeah, and I would say like having like a significant other is like the same thing as like getting a job. So those two are the same. So okay, getting a tutor, getting a job, and a
significant other.
Yeah, or significant other
who doesn't speak English,
or
speaks just enough English, but your Japanese is better than hers.
Yes.
So I guess when you first come, your Japanese isn't going to be better, right? You're going to be at zero. Your Japanese is at zero, basically.
Yeah, but, I mean, some people won't care.
Yeah, body language. Actually, I've had a couple of friends that dated girls where they couldn't communicate, basically, but they just understood each other. Like, he spoke no Japanese, she spoke no English. So, you know, how do you communicate? But people find ways, you know?
I mean, when you're walking around the city on a date, you know, you're just pointing at stuff and joking and laugh. I mean, you're in that, like, early romance honeymoon stage with, you know, this person. It's probably like anything that's funny, but eventually at some point, if you can't truly communicate, things are going to end.
But it's a good start. It's a good start. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And then, so you say those are joint two.
Yeah, yeah.
So you say you're going to give a fourth one.
Basically. Yeah. Well, I would say those are both two. But yeah, this the fourth one, again, I would say, well, this might be looped with having a tutor, but I would say those tests are probably what have always helped build my vocabulary.
Go for the JLPT.
Yeah.
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 See, if I had this advice when I first came here, I reckon my Japanese would be a lot better, because I think I didn't do any of those. I might have done number two, the joint two one, like fine. No, I didn't do that either. I did none of them. Yeah.
Well, so what would you say is like top three or top two?
Well, I don't think I'm in a good place to give advice, because my Japanese isn't anywhere near as good as yours.
But looking back, or even, I mean, but you are communicating in daily life in Japanese sometimes, so.
So what I should have done, I think, I would have done the same way how I learned how to speak, which is to, you know, I went to my local bar and just chat to locals. I would have got a significant other who spoke no English. I think I would have done that. But at the time, I guess I wasn't confident enough. So I was always like dating girls that could speak English or a little bit of English, you know. So I definitely would have done that. And I probably would have got a private tutor as well, like you said. And I definitely would have started learning kanji straight from the beginning, because now I know how important it is. It's like so important to know that.
And it just takes time. So the earlier you start.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you don't know that, you're basically illiterate. I've been illiterate for 8 years in Japan. Can't read or write anything. You know?
Yeah.
I'm just like an idiot pretty much. And I always need people to help me. You know, read. Oh, can you read this very important letter? It's about like tax and stuff like that. I can't read any of that.
Yeah, well, it's a handicap, literally. I mean,
and but people can get along finally without it. I had a great time for 8 years. You know, even not being able to read or write Japanese, it didn't hinder my lifestyle so much. You know, because you know, for 8 years, even though I wasn't even that motivated to learn how to read and write until. Yeah, just recently. I don't know why, just something like clicked in my brain. Was like, I want to be able to read this sign, you know, because it could be important. Or maybe one day if there's no one around that can help me, which hasn't actually happened yet. There's always seems to be, I have friends or, you know, coworkers that can always help me when I'm in a bind. And it's amazing how helpful Japanese people are.
Yeah.
You know, like my coworkers, they do everything for me. And I guess I kind of feel a bit guilty about taking their time, you know, like even at work, I bring in like personal stuff and like bills and letters, and I'm like, oh, what does this say? And they're always just so happy to help me.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe because for them, it's also good practice to learn some English, you know, but they just always seem just so happy to help me. And I feel like bad about it, but always like, given presents, and you know, I'm very grateful. But then I finally realized, okay, I've got to start getting this kanji down. So now, the last couple of years, I started to learn kanji.
Yeah.
Okay, so and another way, what do you think are the three best ways to study reading, like kanji?
Well,
or to learn kanji, because a lot of people have problems with that. I think that's probably the hardest part of learning Japanese is the kanji. Even a lot of Japanese people don't know a lot of kanji.
Yeah, and I'll say, like, I can't write, but obviously I don't need to, because now it's just all like a cell phone or a computer, so I can type and I don't need to write.
Yeah, that's amazing. There's so much like good software that you can just type even how it's said or how it's read, and then switch some buttons, and then you can find the kanji. And if you recognize it, then you just select it. So, yeah, you don't even have to learn how to write, really.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the process that I went through to study so that I can kind of answer your question. But I think the very first thing I did that was helpful, obviously you have to master to some degree like hiragana and katakana just because that'll help you with studying
kanji. Can you give our listeners a rundown of what hiragana and katakana is?
Yeah, so basically, like you're saying, there's a few different alphabets in Japanese. There's the kanji, which is based on the Japanese characters. There's the hiragana, which is kind of the curvy original Japanese alphabet.
Right, so this was before kanji, right, hiragana?
I don't know, actually. Was it?
Because I know, like, the Tale of Genji, which is supposedly one of the oldest books ever written in Japanese, mm-hmm. was all in hiragana.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think they got kanji from Chinese.
Right.
Hiragana is actually the original Japanese language.
Okay.
Yeah, the written language.
Okay. Yeah, maybe some people out there know better than we do what the origins of the alphabet.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that, but I know Tale of Genji was all written in hiragana.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the third one is katakana, which is kind of this sharp, straight, similar to hiragana alphabet that they use for loan words or words from other languages such as English or Danish and stuff.
Man, I hate katakana. I hate it.
I think it's probably, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to hate it, but why do you hate it?
Well, because, like, the way it's written is there's only one way to pronounce something. So it depends on who, I don't even know who decides how it's pronounced. So every time there's a word, for example, they call football, which we call football in England, they call soccer. But it's spelled, we say soccer, but the Japanese say saka, right?
Saka. Mm.
And that's based on the American word soccer. Is that it? Soccer.
Soccer. Soccer, yeah. Soccer.
So it's so that's the only way it's pronounced, right? So right. if you pronounce it differently, they don't understand what it is. And yeah. That is really annoying because we don't say soccer. We say soccer. Like English people say soccer. So if I said that to a Japanese person, do you play soccer? Yeah. They're like, well, what's soccer?
Yeah.
You have to say soccer. And all katakana's like that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Which is so annoying because if you don't know how it's pronounced in the Japanese way, you might be able to read it and you think you're saying it right. And people just, like, if you're not saying it right, they don't understand you at all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's definitely one reason to hate it. Another reason a lot of people hate it, especially English teachers, is because they say, and I believe this too, it kind of destroys Japanese people's English ability because they grow up thinking they're learning English words, but they're learning it with such a destroyed pronunciation that native speakers can't really recognize what they're saying on the flip side either. And they just grow up, I mean, why not just learn it romaji or alphabet letters?
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. From just the learn the alphabet because they know the alphabet, like they know A, B, C, D.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's based on, you know, the sounds or phonics in Japanese are obviously much different than Western languages, and katakana allows them to use those phonics. I think I'm using the right words to be able to pronounce a foreign word or something. But I mean, if you're teaching children from a young enough age, and this just gets to a huge long debate because then they start to say, well, there's not teachers, enough native Japanese teachers who have that native or foreign native fluency to be able to teach
right,
children.
And the right pronunciation, the right accent, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's katakana, which both of us don't like at all.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Well, this kind of
how
going
you
back
studied,
to
how you studied, yeah.
Yeah. So again, how did I pick up kanji? In the very beginning, there was this book that kind of like talked about, you know, it was like the first 150 kanji that you needed to know for like the proficiency test, and it kind of compared it to like pictures. It's like the one for person, hito, kind of look like a person standing or something.
Was this like an actual book for learners of Japanese, or was it like for elementary Japanese kids or something?
No, this was for foreign people. So it was, yeah, the foreign way to learn kanji. It wasn't the Japanese way.
So it's relating to pictures and
yeah, which
symbols.
Is, yeah, which I, hesitated to do that because I was like, Japanese people don't learn this way. I'm not, why am I going to do it the foreign way? But when you think about it, like making those connections in your mind is one of the best ways to learn anything.
Well, that's the thing, because the Japanese, they learn it by just writing it out 100 times, 1,000 times. They don't really have a, I mean, their system works, but they start at a very young age, which is why it works.
Yeah.
But when you're starting at an older age, then that method is not as effective.
Right.
Right.
Well, when I was going to some of these Japanese schools and we would have quizzes, kanji quizzes, like I would do that kind of Japanese way of studying too, just because you wanted to learn how to write it.
For me, that didn't work. I tried that way. I tried writing out a kanji like 50 times, you know, and it just didn't work. It just wouldn't stick.
Well, the reason I would do it that way is because you wanted to be able to write it fast enough to finish within the time of the quiz. So that was kind of the main reason, you know.
Yeah.
But for, yeah. Like,
but did it work? Did it work for you?
It worked for like that day and then it would be gone.
Yeah, right. So it's like you wasted so much time writing 50 kanji down and you can remember it for a very short amount of time, but it doesn't stick.
So the first thing I did was use that book.
The picture book, right?
Yeah. And then after that, there were some books that were for the proficiency test. And they weren't, I'm not talking about the kanji ones. I'm talking about like the grammar books and the reading comprehension books. And when you just start to study articles and when you look at the kanji in the article and you learn, it is necessary to learn how to write it, even if you can't remember it, because it helps to kind of start to recognize what kanji is and what's very similar. Because even Japanese kanji is different from Chinese kanji sometimes, right? The characters are slightly different.
That's right, yeah. I think one of them is simplified. So, but like my family, who are all from Hong Kong and they're Chinese, yeah, they can read like Japanese kanji. Mm-hmm. They can't say it, but they know what it means. So when my mum came over, she was like, she could read all the food menus,
right?
So she knew like more than me in terms of like the menus and stuff. Okay. Oh, this is chicken, this is pork, this is beef and stuff like that. But she couldn't say it, but she knew what it was.
Yeah But studying those like vocabulary and the explanations and grammar and getting familiar with those kanji characters. And then, I mean, and it's funny, and anyone who's ever studied Japanese and probably for studying any language, they always say it like, when you study something that day and then like you'll go out in the real world and sometimes you'll hear it that exact same day or you'll see it that exact same day or the next day or something. There's just that weird coincidence. And those books are actually really structured on like a good kind of like a flow of how you should learn things, because how common you'll start to encounter them in real life and stuff.
Getting the right textbook is quite important, would you say?
I think definitely, because those books, like, they kind of build off of like the very elementary level. It's just like the simplest things that you need to know to survive.
Man, maybe you'd have to tell me what these books are like after the show, because that might help me out.
I have, because
I always struggle with which textbooks to buy, because there's so many textbooks out there.
Yeah, but the things about these textbooks is like, if you don't do them along with taking the test, then it's so easy to quit, you know, studying.
But so sign up for that test, and then that will at least give you a goal.
Yeah, motivation. And again, if you do it with a tutor, probably the most important thing about the tutor is not that they, like, correct you and help you, but they structure, like, here's the test in, like, 2 months. This is the schedule that we're going to be on, and they keep you on that schedule. They know what's realistic for you to learn within a certain... I mean, it's like having a coach for sports, you know?
Yeah, so the best thing is kind of setting a goal. Like, you've had that test and having that tutor that knows exactly how the test is done, the steps necessary.
Yeah, and the build-up...
they guide you.
Yeah, like, now I know. So if I buy these textbooks in advance of the test, I kind of know, like, how... Okay, so there's this many chapters in this book. How much should I try to do within a week? And back, you know, calculating back from that, how much should I do each day? And, it's hard to do that if you don't have the experience. And those tutors or those teachers, they can set up that structure for you, your study structure. And then after that, they walk you through it and they give you they make up the quizzes for it and the tests that help you.
Like the kanji quizzes and
all of
stuff
it.
Like
yeah,
that.
The kanji quizzes, the vocabulary quizzes. And that's the thing, like those books are, they're kind of like the test, so they're broken up into different sections like listening, reading comprehension, vocabulary and stuff. And but they're kind of all related too. So the things that you'll see in one book on a certain chapter will correlate with other things in other books.
I mean, do you think that someone could study kanji solely by themselves, like, and just knuckle down, figure out a way of studying it by themselves, be disciplined? Do you think that's possible?
I think so, because a lot of periods when I was doing it, that's what I was doing. I had, like, you know, I had Electric Dictionary, but I also had, like, one of those books that you taught you how to, like, look up kanji characters within a dictionary. And I was kind of doing that on my own. Yeah, I think it's totally possible, yeah.
So, I mean, like, now that I've started studying kanji, I have a tutor now as well, like a private tutor, but trying to find a fun way of studying kanji. So have you heard of, like, the Hazig method?
No.
So James Hazig, he wrote, like, a book called Remembering the Kanji.
Okay.
And basically each kanji, he constructs a story. So, for example, the number 10, or no, let's do an easy one. So the number 3, for example, is just 3 lines. So he'll make a story that has something about 3 lines in it. So that's just a really simple way. But then he uses each of those stories, and if that kanji, like that symbol, is a part of another kanji, then he'll use that same story and connect it with another story.
Okay.
So it's like slowly building up, and you're building stories in your memory.
This guy is strictly somebody who is teaching on learn kanji, or was learning, because I've heard these the similar method just for any type of memory.
This is just for kanji. Your
okay,
just for kanji. Yeah. So, well, he's just looking at it now. He's a philosopher, mm-hmm. or was a he's a philosopher born in 1944. And this remembering kanji is one of the most kind of famous methods for learning the kanji, like in a fun kind of interesting way. And I tried it out. And it was more fun and it was more interesting, but it was slow. It was really slow.
Okay.
So I can't, yeah, I can't.
Because it's like a story, long story just for one character.
Yeah, but also, like, at the beginning, it's only teaching you the meaning. Mm-hmm. So what the kanji means.
Okay.
So I was just learning the kanji meanings, but I wasn't learning how to say them or how to read them.
Oh, I see.
So so his method is learn all the meanings first,
right?
So then when you see it, you know what it means, and then you're learning how to say it after.
Okay.
Which is a very slow process.
It is, but it maybe, like, once you have that base, it might, like, down the line, it might actually help.
Yeah he said he recommended only doing it that way, like learning the meaning only, not the meaning and the reading at the same time, because he says you kind of get confused, there's just so much going in. But once you have that foundation of the meaning, the readings come really quickly,
okay.
Especially if you're, like, living in Japan. You know, some words you already know already, like how to say.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I tried it out. I did it for about 6 months, I think. And it was, for me, it was just a bit too slow. So then I changed that up. And I just use, do you know Anki app?
Yeah, yeah.
Heard
it before,
yeah. Just, like, you put in the kanji. You know, it's like a flashcard, basically, but on your phone or online. So I just use that. And then every day I'm, like, studying kanji, just looking at the kanji, looking at the reading, looking at the meaning. And it's set up so if you know, you can click, like, I remember this, and then it reminds you in, like, 7 days, 4 days, or whatever. And then the ones that you don't remember, you can click, like, 10 minutes, 1 minute, and it just keeps reviewing and reviewing. And then when you remember it, click, okay, I'm done with that one. And then that'll come back in, like, a week or something.
Right.
And it's just a constant review.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be really effective, actually. So that's my method of studying kanji now. And it seems to be sinking in quite quickly.
Yeah, and just kind of going back to the, you were asking, like, what were the top 3 methods or something. I would say also one thing before I came over here that I was told this is, like, the best method to learning the language is to memorize conversations. And so a lot of these textbooks, they have, like, these structured conversations that you study from.
So this is to learn speaking language.
Yeah, just to memorize those conversations. And because if you can repeat a conversation, then all of that's already in your head. And I've heard this is how a lot of the church missionaries actually, they pick up improve their fluency so well, is because they have all of these like conversations memorized of how they're going to kind of proselytize or talk to people that they meet.
Man, that's awesome. That's like such a great tip. I never heard of that before.
Yeah. So before I came, I bought like 3 books and just like tried to memorize all the conversations in these books about, because it's in your head to refer back to. Obviously, the conversation is not going to go exactly how it is in that book. That was one thing. And then another thing that was an enjoyable way for me to learn was there was an internet program called like Yes Japan. It was this guy, George, who had grown up in like some place in Honshu. He lived there in high school or something. He was like fluent in Japanese, but he was a really entertaining guy, and he would put up like these 30-minute programs with these Japanese female like guests or something, co-hosts, and they talked about all sorts of stuff, like dating in Japan and all sorts of things that people would really be interested in. And that's probably what actually a lot of people are doing these days. They're probably using YouTube and a lot of these other methods that we didn't have when, at least I first came, none of that was here. So,
yeah. So let's wrap it up. But to summarize, is Japanese a hard language to learn?
They say it's probably one of the hardest to learn for a Western speaker, but obviously it's doable.
All right. And just quickly, what do you need to do to get good at Japanese in the quickest amount of time?
Get to Japan.
That's the start. All right, guys. Well, we're going to wrap it up. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Cheers.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed the episode, even though it was quite long and there were many, many topics that we covered. After we finished, we realized there were some very fun techniques that we didn't even get into, such as reading Japanese comic books, otherwise known as manga, or also going to karaoke with friends. So we think there's probably enough to make another episode all about this. But for now, we hope you enjoyed this episode, and as always, please check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, Voices in Japan. And if you enjoyed the episode, please be sure to share it with your friends and ask them to subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.